According to the talking heads of Fox News, the word liberal is a terrible slur. It's hurled around to insult people on the left and playing a gamut of ills, from being a hypersensitive snowflake to favouring great big government programs like universal healthcare. Here in Australia, where our increasingly conservative party of government is deceptively packaged as the Liberal Party, the word has a very different meaning, one based on individual rights and a smaller government. Which one, if any, is right? And what are the origins and the future of the political philosophy of liberalism? Elena Rosenblatt is professor at history at the Graduate Centre, City University of New York. And we were saying off air that the City University is a public university, and it's one of the biggest public universities in the US.
That's right. It's the largest urban public university in the United States, with approximately 270,000 students.
Cop that. Now, Elena has written many books on political history and philosophy. Her newy, which I'll hold up to the microphone so you can all see it, is The Lost History of Liberalism, From Ancient Rome to the 21st Century. And it's marvellous to have Elena actually sitting with me in our Sydney studio. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you very much for having me.
When you were researching, and I quote, "I couldn't help noticing that liberalism was often called a slippery, elusive, or vague concept in the books and articles that I read. And all of it led me to ask a deceptively simple question. What is liberalism?" Okay, Elena, what is it?
What is it? Well, that's what I try to explain in my book. And as you say, there has been controversies and debates about this. And actually, this goes back to the very, very beginning. Liberalism has been a contested concept from the time the word was coined in the early 19th century, and we've argued over it ever since. Conservatives and liberals have. On the other hand, there has been a core meaning to the word going way back to Roman times, and I think the core meaning, though, the way this has expressed itself, has evolved over time, because liberals generally have been interested in circumstances and been practical and have adapted their core philosophy to the problems of their times.
Is liberalism in crisis today? That's known as a Dorothy Dixer, because the answer we know.
Absolutely. The liberal democracy is very much in crisis today. We see illiberal democracies rising around the world, even in America. We speak of populism. We speak of authoritarianism. We speak of leaders who call themselves Democrats and are voted into power democratically, but then they turn against certain principles, core principles of liberal democracy, like separation of power, like even the rule of law, and like core liberal rights like freedom of speech, freedom of the press.
Night after night, we sit here and bemoan a world in which some very unpleasant things are happening, but I wonder whether Trump isn't causing some blowback. Is he perhaps recruiting some liberals?
Well, absolutely. You're right. And what's super interesting, we find today, and troubling to many in the Democratic Party, which is often referred to as the liberal, the liberals are the Democratic Party today, is the emergence of socialism. Some liberals are now talking about...
I'm sorry, wash your mouth out. How dare you come on this program?
I know.
Use that lewd word.
Yeah, exactly. We are talking about American liberalism, which, as you said at the outset, is different, and we can talk about why it is different in America from in colloquial speech. Liberalism in America means, you know, big government, government regulation, government intervention. But as you also said, liberalism is a dirty word in many quarters, and goes back to Reagan, who spoke about the dreaded L word. Well, now we have the emergence of the dreaded S word. We have the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, which you might have heard about, and now we have this very charismatic female, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Big fans of hers.
I bet. And she calls herself a democratic socialist. So now we have liberals among themselves debating, can you be a liberal and a socialist? God forbid. And you have Trump responding by saying that the Democrats want to turn America into Venezuela.
I want to riffle back through your book, and people often trace its origins to Magna Carta in Britain. That's not accurate, is it?
No, it isn't. And that's one of the discoveries you make when you read my book and you adopt my methodology. It's commonly thought that liberalism goes back to the Magna Carta and then was refined and rearticulated by someone like John Locke, who's regarded as a founding father of liberalism. And from England, it developed and spread and eventually came to America, where it was enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. And then it was spread across the world. Well, what I find is actually, if you look at the word itself and when it was coined and when there were self-titled, self-identified liberals, this actually happened right after the French Revolution as an outcome of the revolution. And for a very long time, liberalism was associated with France. When you look,
It's interesting that the Encyclopedia Americana of 1831 didn't contain an entry on liberalism, and the article on liberal explained that its political meaning came, yes, from France.
That's right. And only half a century later do you find the entry liberalism in an encyclopedia of political science in America, where it is actually a translation of a French article. So this idea that liberalism is naturally American or that it's an Anglo-American tradition is false. Liberalism as a word and a concept, as a political word and concept, I should explain, only came to America in the beginning of the 20th century, excuse me.
The English philosopher John Locke was one of the most influential thinkers of the Enlightenment, often referred to as the father of liberalism, but you want to knock him off his pedestal.
Well, I do, because, of course, when you adopt this methodology, when you look at the use of the word liberal and what it meant to the people at the time, which I believe is the properly historical approach, you will see that Locke never referred to himself as a liberal. Nobody for a very long time until the 20th century called him a liberal in that political sense. The noun was not in use. When he spoke of somebody being liberal, he meant the term in the traditional sense, a sense that a meaning that goes back to Rome and referred to the noble qualities of a citizen, of a gentleman in Locke's period, somebody who was generous, who was freedom-loving in a way, who was devoted to the common good. So in that sense, he would have liked to think of himself as being liberal, even though he was no exponent of liberalism, a concept or a cluster of concepts he could not have imagined or conceived of.
You gave Rome a mention in Dispatches, and of course the book is subtitled From Ancient Rome to the 21st Century. Let's go to Rome. Yeah. Talk about liberalism in that context.
Well, right. Liberalism, so the word and the concept did not exist in Rome. What you had then was the term, the Latin term, liber and liberalitas. Most people, when they translate liber today, speak of it as meaning freedom. And of course it does mean freedom, but it also meant generosity at the time. So the qualities of a citizen, and in Rome that meant somebody who wasn't a slave, and it was an elite. The being liberal meant, again, loving freedom and being generous, understanding your place in the republic, your duties as a citizen, devotion to the common good. It was an ideal. Obviously, everyone wasn't that.
So there is a continuity, isn't there, over the centuries, in a sense that when we use the term liberal, it is often just a way of expressing a progressive view or a sense of social responsibility.
Yes, we think of it as involving commitment to progress and to improvement. I would say that this came later, however, the notion of progress and improvement, and I think we owe it more to the Enlightenment than we do to ancient Rome or to the medieval period or even the Renaissance. I think this idea that that all of society is improving and liberality and becoming liberal is something that's happening more and more. This is a contribution of the Enlightenment that starts to speak of, use the word liberal, the adjective liberal, to refer to a condition of society more broadly, not just individuals, not just the elite qualities of a gentleman or an educated person. The word starts to have a more expansive meaning over time.
I'm talking to Helena Rosenblatt. Her book, The Lost History of Liberalism, and this, of course, is LNL on RN. Back to the French. You've written an entire book on Rousseau, so play him into the narrative.
That's a wonderful question. I worked for a long time. My dissertation was on Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he is generally not regarded as a liberal thinker, and I think that is, or as a contributor to the liberal tradition. He is somebody who liberals had to contend with, however. Everyone pretty much after Rousseau, if they were a major thinker, had to deal with his thought. But he was used, let's say, by the Jacobins during the French Revolution to justify a kind of people power that was direct and that was regarded as dangerous by liberals because of what happened during the French Revolution. He spoke about popular sovereignty, and that popular sovereignty could not be represented or divided, but should, you know, rule, let's say. And liberals became horrified by this concept when they saw how very much the revolution derailed off course during the period we call the Terror, and with the direct activity of the crowds. The crowds had turned violent, and not only the Terror, I should add, but also Napoleon, who came afterwards and claimed to represent the people. This kind of direct democratic power was anathema to liberals.
Right. Well, that's almost counterintuitive, and I want to get into that in more detail shortly. But your second book was on Benjamin Constant. Tell me about him.
Well, he is more and more frequently regarded correctly, I think, as a true founding father of liberalism. John Locke was not the founding father, but Benjamin Constant and his companion and a great intellectual of her own, Madame de Staël. And they, in France, were really among the very first to use the word liberal to mean a political position. Benjamin Constant witnessed the Terror from abroad, from across the border, but he arrived soon thereafter with Madame de Staël, was very well aware of the problems of popular sovereignty, and then he witnessed the Napoleon, who really disappointed liberals tremendously. And he saw the dangers of unbounded popular sovereignty. It can turn against minorities, it can turn against individuals, and it must be divided and contained. Individual rights must be respected.
Madame de Staël is one of the most fascinating people in history. Let us spend a bit of time with her. Her dad was the state finance minister to Louis the 16th.
That's right. And
unlike Trump, he saw to the the royal budget was published, or the royal tax return, in effect.
Yes, and that is seen as a very controversial move at the time to have done that, to have exposed the king's debt. Many people today feel that that was a something that provoked the revolution. I mean, first of all, the bankruptcy of the French king and the monarchy, but also the fact that he showed everybody this. There was a lot of hostility towards him during the revolution. Madame de Staël was one of the, his daughter was an only child and became, was one of the wealthiest human beings at the time.
She was also very stylish, wasn't she?
She was, and very, a larger-than-life personality, a great conversationalist, a great writer in her own right, and not only of novels. That's what she's famous for now, her novels Delphine and Corinne, but she wrote political texts as well, and masses of letters. And she supported and promoted men who became very important at the time. In the time, women didn't get elected, they didn't even vote, and they rarely got published. But she was a powerhouse, and I think she's a founder of liberalism, along with her partner, Benjamin Constant.
One of the things that's interesting about Helena is that she was a salon hostess, and she held coalition dinners between political rivals.
Yes, she was in many ways a mediator. She supported. She was a friend of Lafayette. She was. She knew him since childhood. She had encountered him in her mother's salon that she was made to attend from a very early age. But she also befriended conservatives and tried to get them to agree in her salon. Now, you know, salons have, until recently and even today, been seen as, yes, places where women kind of hold court and literary discussions are held. And people from the outside, provincial types like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, are kind of polished and educated as to aristocratic manners so that they can appear in court. It's considered kind of a civilizing institution and quite an aristocratic one. Madame de Staël's salon was not that. It was a political meeting place, one of the most important ones of
the
time.
So it was nonetheless a great honor to get invited.
Oh, of course. And a restricted elite was invited there. People like Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson. But you know, her range of correspondence.
So Jefferson sat at that table.
He did. And as you know, Jefferson and Lafayette helped, in fact, write the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. And these discussions that led to that could have taken, such discussions and on the constitutions took place in Madame de Staël's salon.
Thomas Paine?
Thomas Paine, no. She would have known of him, the great responder to Edmund Burke, for example. I think that that whole discussion between Richard Price, Tom Paine, and Edmund Burke is an extremely important one for the history of both conservatism and liberalism. Because, you know, Edmund Burke now and his reflections on the French Revolution are considered a founding text of conservatism. And then you have Madame de Staël responding to Burke and Paine and Price, who's another one, Richard Price, a English Protestant dissenter, in her work.
So here we have Constant and de Staël, in effect, one of the great power couples of their time. They later became lovers.
Yes. Madame de Staël and Benjamin Constant met in 1794, and he immediately fell head over heels in love with her. She not so much. It took a little while for him to woo her. She thought he was brilliant, however. At the time, he was writing a big book on religion that I discuss in my book on Constant that has been neglected by many scholars. But he was writing this book on religion, and he shared immediately some of of the drafts of this book, and she thought he was brilliant and compared him to Montesquieu. And so then this friendship, this deep intellectual complicity and partnership developed over time. There are texts that are attributed to Benjamin Constant and to Madame de Staël, where there are annotations in the margins that indicate that they were actually correcting and working on the same ideas at the same time.
What did these early liberals think of religion, in particular the Catholic Church, which of course dominated pre-revolutionary France?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons there. Liberal anti-Catholicism was so fierce at
the time. And it was mutual, wasn't it?
It was mutual, exactly.
The church detested liberalism.
Yes. Liberals, even in their, you know, Enlightenment thinkers in the 18th century generally thought of Catholicism, many of them, I shouldn't say that as a blanket statement. There were Catholics who were enlightened, there were liberals who were Catholic, but mainly because of the what they perceived as the collusion between absolute monarchy and the Catholic Church, the throne and altar alliance, you might call it. Liberals were anti this church and state complicity and what they regarded and called superstition.
Well, many liberals had the idea of a religion of humanity, a positive religion that did not, quote, dwell on gloomy doctrines about man's sinfulness, nor stress dogmas and the supernatural. Instead, emphasized the importance of moral comportment and belief in man's ability to improve himself.
Yes, exactly. Few liberals were atheists. Most of them were a brand of deists, some Unitarian. They called and were called liberal Christians or liberal Protestants. Somebody like Benjamin Constant and Madame de Staël would have regarded themselves and would be called liberal Protestants. And by that we mean they wanted to pare down dogmas, what they called superstitions, ceremonies.
If you were atheists, could some be called agnostic?
Yes, the reason being that liberals came in all different shapes and sizes. There were even Catholic liberals, a few very important ones. For example, Lord Acton in England, Charles de Montalembert, an important one in France, and many in America. But most, as I said, believed in. Agnosticism in the sense that they didn't agree with dogmas. They wanted people to question the Bible, to engage in criticism of the Bible, and to think on their own feet. Many probably thought that over time, with enlightenment, people would give up many of these superstitions, as they call it, and eventually even perhaps believe in something that they called a rational religion. You know, many of them were also Freemasons. Later on, and that believed really that what human beings needed was a morality.
There was also, just as there was hostility to the Vatican, there was some hostility to Orthodox Judaism.
Yes, among Jews there was this liberal move in the 19th century also, and all along the late 19th century and 20th century, they as well, these groups of reformers, you might say, wanted to update their religion and also shed some of their antiquated beliefs, as they called it. Of course, this upset the Orthodox very much and eventually led to various branches of Judaism, just as it led to different branches among Protestants, the Orthodox, and the more liberal variety.
From time to time, I change the name of Late Night Live to things that amuse me or seem relevant. Very often we're Lennon L, and tonight we're going to be Late Night Liberal in the honour of Helena Rosenblatt, who's sitting with me in the studio, and she's Professor of History at the Graduate Centre, the City University of New York. State-sponsored education, a very important ingredient in the saga.
I'm glad you bring that up, because from the very beginning we were talking about Rome and the meaning of the word liber and liberalitas. And we can think about, for example, a liberal arts education. This idea of a liberal arts education was central to liberals throughout history. And many, if not most, advocated some form of public education. And what was this? It was not vocational training. It was really meant to form citizens, critical thinkers, in a sense, people devoted to the common good, generous, freedom-loving, but also, again, compassionate, true citizens. And wherever you look in the so-called liberal tradition, you will find this commitment to educating and, through education, moralizing the electorate. One of the reasons early liberals were not Democrats was that they felt that the crowds, the general population, did not have capacity, which is a word they used. You needed capacity to have the vote. The vote was a trust, not a right. And so they thought that the wealthy, who were the ones who had access to education, should be given the vote. And as more and more people were given the vote, those people had to be given an education, a public education.
And yet, they were not leading lights in the women's suffrage movement.
Well, I don't know if that's true, because they were probably more for it than their conservative adversaries. But it is disappointing to see liberals for so long opposing openly, not just not advocating, but opposing the vote for women, for example. But what I also would like to emphasize is that when there were women who advocated for their own rights to education, to jobs, and eventually to the vote, they appealed to liberals. And they said, they adopted the sort of liberal language, and they knew who their prospective friends were, in a sense. They said, hey, extend your principles to us. You are being hypocritical. So they didn't go to the conservatives or the counter-revolutionaries, even less, or the Catholic Church, which was definitely against this sort of route for women. They appealed to liberals, and eventually they prevailed.
Helena, what was the historical liberal thinking on imperialism and colonialism?
Well, this is one area in which liberals have been rightly criticized and for being hypocritical, and it's quite disturbing to us, especially today.
John Stuart Mill notoriously said it's okay to rule despotically when you are dealing with barbarians.
Yes, and there were many, frankly, who spoke of natives and brown and black people as barbarians, and of the Anglo-Saxon race being superior. They spoke about the subject races. They spoke about the barbarian races. They thought of them often as one would children. So mostly they believed in a mission to civilize. To us, that sounds terribly hypocritical and condescending. But there was an idealist side to this. At the same time, there was a terrible blindness to the or lack of regard for the violence that it involved blindness. For the oppression.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I suddenly remember Albert Schweitzer, who was regarded as a progressive saint, and he described the African as my brother, but my younger brother.
Yeah.
So that, in a sense, is a
yeah. And I have to say, again, there were liberals who denounced this this pro-imperialist or colonialist view and said it was barbaric, that it was hypocritical, and many did this. Even one early one, Benjamin Constant, for example, denounced imperial conquest. Jean-Baptiste Say is a famous one who argued against imperialism. Frédéric Bastiat. There was a whole number of them who exposed this for what they thought was hypocrisy.
Well, I'm glad you're emphasizing this. At no stage was it monolithic.
Yes, and some people were for it for a while, and then when they saw what it involved, the violence and the cruelty, they changed. Tocqueville is one such person. I mean, there's just horrible sections of Tocqueville where he justifies terrible cruelty in Algeria, and then he comes to regret it. There are mixed feelings, like, yes, it's good, but we shouldn't be violent. We should be loving, even. We should raise them up. We should promote self-government. And they did often think that over time, after this, with this civilizing mission, the subjugated races would be lifted up and be able to govern themselves. At least this is what they said. Now, they also said that some parts of the world and some races would be easier to civilize than others. And often it was the white races who would be able to govern themselves quicker than the black races. Now, I would like to add one thing, and that is that the concept of race was a bit muddled at the time, too. Sometimes when you read these people carefully, you understand it's like a cultural thing. They can speak about the Anglo-Saxon race, and it seems that if you learn English and the culture, then maybe you're a part of that race. And then other times it sounds like something inherited through blood. It is muddled.
This is Late Night Liberal on RN. Download us wherever you get your podcasts or listen on the ABC Listen app. Sitting with me in the studio, Elena Rosenblatt, historian from the City University of New York, and her book is The Lost History of Liberalism. Well, one of the parts that deserve to be lost is the low point in your book, learning about the intellectual connection between liberalism, the rise of social Darwinism, eugenics in particular, and the scientific racism of the early 20th century.
Yes, this is really a low point and a very dark side of liberalism. Again, not just liberals. So it's not a distinguishing factor. It's not a defining issue for liberalism. Unfortunately, across the political spectrum in Europe, there was this belief that one could genetically control the population and ensure that the or try to weed out the unfit, the so-called unfit.
It was not only popular, of course, with Hitler. It was very popular in the United States, where eugenics used to have displays at state fairs of human beings as well as stock.
Yes, and they had they had enforced sterilization, for example. Woodrow Wilson, one of the first people to use the word liberal as a foreign policy concept, wanted to not only spread democracy but liberalism in World War I. He signed a forced sterilization bill. And, you know, it was this unfit category. It was very capacious. It could include people with epilepsy, people regarded as unemployable, I'm putting quotation marks around that. Even criminals, and how criminals were defined, or who gets to decide who's a criminal is very vague. I should say also that there was something called positive eugenics and negative eugenics, or that's what academics now differentiate them. So positive, it meant encouraging healthy children to be born. And you're right. This is before Hitler, way before Hitler. You see it in England, you see it in America, you see it in France. The French were more for the positive type of eugenics. In other words, encouraging healthy children. And how'd you do that? Well, for example, factory legislation to reduce the hours of work for women in the factories. A lot of these first moves to intervene and protect workers were for women and children and to protect the health of the population.
Time for you and I to wrestle, as you do in the book, with the phrase liberal democracy. We call Australia, the UK, Canada, liberal democracies. But the connection between liberalism and democracy is, as you've already said, not a natural pairing.
Yes, today we use it as if it was a simple, easy to understand or unproblematic concept, liberal democracy, and some people use them as synonyms. But as you say, liberalism and the early liberals were even hostile to democracy. As I said earlier, they had seen the crowd activity during the French Revolution. The masses had proved themselves irrational and violent and prone to irrational behavior. Then with Napoleon I and Napoleon III, they voted repeatedly for demagogues and dictators.
And even the sainted Constant thought that the popular sovereignty should be limited and advocated stiff property requirements for voting and office holding.
Yes. They only late did liberals accept democracy, and then they wrote about making it liberal. So we have with Napoleon III in particular in France, we have a number of people accepting democracy, which, by the way, was active or in place with Napoleon, who used plebiscites repeatedly to protect himself and to buttress his rule and what he was doing. And so liberals said, we have to make democracy liberal. And by this, I think not only that we wanted to protect individual rights and particularly protect freedom of the press, which was a very big deal for liberals, but to educate, to uplift the population. If they were going to give the vote, they had to be given capacity. And so here again, you see repeatedly liberals arguing for public education, freedom of the press, all of this to educate the voting public. So they accepted democracy reluctantly, but they wanted it uplifted.
Madame de Staël talked about the government of the best, but at least this thread in liberalism wants to make many more people of the best.
Yes, exactly. And absolutely. Today it's sometimes accused of being elitist.
Well, I was going to raise that term because the conservatives on Fox News keep saying of liberals that they're elitist, but there's some truth in that, isn't there?
There is some truth. On the other hand, the liberals thought it being part of the elite required a number of obligations, and they stressed them again and again. So it was not just about their right to govern, it was also about their duty to think about the common good and to promote policies that would be good for everyone. I think this is something that has dropped out of the histories of liberalism and the books about liberalism, whether they attack liberalism or defend liberalism today. They tend to speak of individual rights and interests, and they forget about this almost obsession with promoting morals, commitment to the common good, and education. And they expected a lot from this elite, and they did expect it to expand over time. There was a march of equality, said Benjamin Constant in one place. It was just going to be gradual over time. I think they did see a democracy coming. It was in the future. Look at Tocqueville, for example, The Democracy in America, where he writes that democracy is providential. So, you know, he's telling French liberals, get used to it. You know?
It's a bit like an Ambit claim, isn't it, where a union asks for a big pay rise, knows it's beyond reach, but it's something there to work
They're
towards.
They're aiming towards it, yes. Yeah.
You make an historical finding which will surprise many listeners. And the listener's name, incidentally, is Gladys. And that is that liberalism and socialism used to sit together. There were people in the early 20th century, including a young British politician. What was his name again? Winston Churchill, who called themselves liberal socialists. I had no idea that Churchill had ever used that term.
Yes, he had. He told liberals not to be worried about that term in particular. But here again, it's really about definitions, and people should know this today, because today, some critics, even enemies of this socialist turn in America in particular, associate socialism with revolution and the philosophy of Karl Marx. But early socialism was not that, and it meant really concern for the poor.
It was quasi-religious in a way.
It was, too. There were many religious thinkers, even theologians, who called themselves socialist and were...
I believe Jesus often used the term.
I won't answer that one.
Okay, so nonetheless, there was a time when there was a linkage between liberalism and socialism, and there's a hint of that now in modern America.
There is, and this is what's worrying some liberals. They have all sorts of names in America now. It's very funny, and they're divided among themselves, which is, I think, quite dangerous. There are the progressives, there are the establishment liberals, there are the socialist liberals, the democratic socialists, and these terms are being bandied about, and people are worried about this. Are they going to be divided against the Trump threat? And, I did want to say that there is another interesting discovery, I think, in my book, which relates to this question of socialism. And this is the German contribution to liberalism. Very few people, France and Germany have generally been written out of histories of liberalism because liberalism has been seen as this Anglo-American tradition going back to the Magna Carta and John Locke. But the fact is that France invented liberalism and Germany rearticulated it in the later or mid to late 19th century. And often it was, yes, a kind of religious, but in that liberal religious, not orthodox community of thinkers who thought that it was a great shame, a moral failing of the liberals not to intervene more substantially to help the lives of the poor. And so liberals listened to this in England and France. These writings of these German political economists were translated and disseminated, and people listened. And you have the new, so-called new liberals in England, people like Hobson and Hobhouse and their followers, beginning to say, listen, government has to intervene to make freedom possible. It's about opportunities, and the economy is leaving people in poverty.
I know you regularly contact Madame de Staël by Ouija board. What does she make of Trump's declaration of the state of emergency in his wall?
I don't think she would have been surprised. She had to deal with Napoleon. Napoleon one time said that, no, not Napoleon, at the time of Napoleon, people said there were three powers in Europe, England, Russia, and Madame de Staël. So she recognized a demagogue when she saw one, and she fought him with all her might, and I would imagine that she would not care for Mr. Trump.
We must get her on the program. Helena, thank you very, very much for your time. You've been terrific. Helena Rosenblatt, Professor of History at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and her book, The Lost History of Liberalism from Ancient Rome to the 21st Century, and it's published by Princeton University Press.